Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the QuietMark podcast. I'm your host, Simon Gosling, CMO at QuietMark. QuietMark is the independent international approval award program associated with the UK Noise Abatement Society Charitable Foundation. It encourages companies worldwide to prioritise noise reduction within the design of everyday machines and appliances and find solutions to noise problems to benefit health and well-being. I was doing a spot of early Christmas shopping online the other day, and there, in the section called Books You May Like, was a book called Sound and Noise, A Listener's Guide to Everyday Life by Marcia Jenneth Epstein. Naturally, I clicked the link, and after reading only the first few lines of the description, I realised I had to reach out to the author to see if she would appear as a guest on our show. So we connected on Twitter, and I sent her a message and was delighted when she accepted the invitation. So let me tell you a little bit about the author. Marcia Jenneth Epstein, PhD, is a musicologist and cultural historian, an early music specialist gone somewhat postmodern, now active in acoustic ecology and soundscape studies. She teaches acoustic communications, how sound, including music and noise, conveys information, intercultural communications, and interdisciplinary cultural social history courses in the departments of Anthropology and of Communications, Media and Film at the University of Calgary in Canada. Current projects include researching the mysteries in identified worldwide hum phenomena, activism for conscious listening and noise abatement, and composing music for chamber choirs while awaiting the post-pandemic resumption of live rehearsals. So I'm now going to read the description of the book, which is what grabbed my attention in the first place. This book is about how you listen and what you hear, about how to have a dialogue with the sounds that surround you. Marcia Jenneth Epstein gives readers the impetus and the tools to understand the sounds and noise that define their daily lives in this groundbreaking interdisciplinary study of how auditory stimuli impact both individuals and communities. Epstein employs scientific and sociological perspectives to examine noise in multiple contexts, as a threat to health and peace of mind, as a motivator for social cohesion, as a potent form of communication and expression of power. She draws on a massive base of specialist literature from fields as diverse as nursing and neuroscience, sociology and sound studies, acoustic ecology and urban planning, engineering, anthropology and musicology, among others, synthesizing and explaining these findings to evaluate the ubiquitous effect of sound in everyday life. Epstein investigates speech and music as well as noise, and explores their physical and cultural dimensions. Ultimately, she argues for an engaged public dialogue on sound, built on a shared foundation of critical listening, and provides us with the understanding we need in order to speak and be heard in such a discussion. Sound and Noise is a timely evaluation of the noise that surrounds us, how we hear it, and what we can do about it. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Marcia Jenneth Epstein.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and an honour.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. And thank you for accepting our invitation to be on the show. You're miles away. Would you tell the listeners whereabouts you're situated as we speak?
Ah, yes. I'm in Canada, in Calgary, Alberta, which is right near the Rocky Mountains.
We started there with an introduction to the book, which is now available on Amazon, Sound and Noise, A Listener's Guide to Everyday Life. So the first obvious question, Marcia, is why did you write the book?
Well, when I started, which was several years ago, there was really not much literature out there, except in engineering, about what's going on with sound around us in cities, in places where there are factories, manufacturing going on, in air travel, and in just everyday entertainment. The sound levels at outdoor rock concerts, for example, are comparable to jet engines. And that's not really good for anybody. The airport workers have to wear very powerful noise-canceling headphones on the job. At outdoor concerts, there is no such protection. And people are having their hearing damaged. And that led me into all kinds of ways in which sound is impacting our health and our community relations and our sense of what reality is, even, because we're losing touch with the natural sound of the outdoors.
The natural sound.
I've seen people on hikes in the Rockies wearing earphones with, you know, plugged into music, and you know, it just makes me wonder, okay, what's going on here? So this has been a several years long investigation of what's going on here.
It's very interesting. There's a program which is doing very well on Netflix as we speak called The Social Dilemma. And it talks about an addiction to our smartphones and to social media, which people associate as a visual thing. It even goes to show how the big social tech companies are after our eyeballs and want to give us as much visual stimuli to engage us. But even when we're not looking at the device, what you said there about people when they're not looking at a screen, they've nevertheless got headphones plugged in and are on these hikes wearing headphones. And I am guilty as charged. I cycle a lot and often wear headphones, listening to podcasts when I cycle. Nevertheless, doing what I do for a living, I find a place to park my bike, take the headphones out, and I do listen to nature, having learned valuable lessons from people like Oliver Heath, who's a biophilic designer, who was a guest on episode 3, who talks about the benefits of reconnecting with nature. Is there a hope with your book that you might awaken people to the importance of unplugging and listening to the natural world?
That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, yes, and I am hoping it will have that effect. Mm. I guess we'll see. I've been assigning sound walls to my students at the University of Calgary. I do a course on basically how to listen, how sound communicates, and what we can learn from it. And over again, they report that the walk they took under the instructions not to have anything plugged into anything and not to be talking, just to go on a walk quietly and listen, many of them report that it's the first time they've done that, which was a bit of a shock.
Goodness gracious. I was reading a report by the National Trust in the UK that said that only 30% of children under the age of 9 know what a magpie sounds like, but 90% of UK children know what a Dalek sounds like. A Dalek, for international listeners, being the enemy in the hit TV show Doctor Who. And you see young children being given devices at younger and younger ages. When we had our warm-up chat yesterday, you mentioned the noise of toys. This is a problem which is starting very early in life. Is that right?
It is, yes. Toys marketed for babies, 1 year old and younger, can reach volume levels that will damage a small child's hearing. So what is not known yet, because there haven't been longitudinal studies done yet, at least none that have been published, what is not known is whether that causes sufficient damage to affect the child's ability to learn. And that's a real question, because it's well known that noise in schools affects children's learning.
Yeah.
And what we don't know yet, because it needs a lot of longitudinal studies over several years, probably a decade or more, what we don't know is whether early damage to hearing has an effect on causing children to have trouble with processing information. There's a pretty strong suspicion that it does, because shorter-term studies have shown that, yes, it does.
What can we do to raise awareness to this? I suppose writing a book, doing podcasts, these are one thing, but I suppose, and actually thinking about it, it's what Quiet Mark endeavours to do through the distinctive purple logo of the Quiet Mark logo. When people see that on products, they know that they're... And funnily enough, Marcia, one of the things we've seen in lockdown, as work from home becomes the new normal, as they call it, is we've seen a great rise in searches for people trying to source quiet appliances, because they're suddenly aware just how loud their fridge or their washing machine might be. And consumers are really looking to these appliances. Now, they're doing that for things that adults buy for adults, you know, fridges, freezers, the home. Hopefully that awareness will pass on to people having young children, and recognition that, wow, if I need a quieter fridge in order to concentrate on my Zoom call, maybe my child needs quieter toys to concentrate on their learning.
That's a very good point, although small children can be noisy in themselves, of course.
One of the things you were saying to me yesterday was that the hearing that people used to have in their 50s is now what people are having in their 20s.
Yes, it's certainly not everyone, but heavy users of earbuds with loud music plugged in, or even, I suppose, loud podcasts, although they wouldn't get as loud as music. There's a certain percentage, and it's more males than females listening that loud. But, you know, the gap is closing. That statistic refers to industrial workers in their 50s. So that's not office workers. That's people who are exposed to regular, fairly loud noise. And it's certainly not a majority of people in their 20s or their teens, but it's a significant minority. And one of the really startling things that's been found out recently about hearing damage, especially if it happens early in life, it's hard to catch because, unlike blindness, it's not a sudden onset, you know, as from an accident, for example. It's not something like breaking a leg where you notice it's happening. It builds up over decades. And what has recently been found is that hearing damage is associated with higher risk of dementia. So this is important from a public health perspective, not just as a matter of preserving hearing, but looking at people's lifetimes and what they are susceptible to. It's becoming a major issue in public health studies. Yeah, so this is serious.
It's very serious, yeah. What other risks are there with noise in relation to our health?
If you live near a factory or an airport or a major highway, even a major intersection in a city, there is chronic noise, constant noise. It, you know, it's up and down, but if it's going on all day without much let up, except at night, that causes stress that affects physical health and quite possibly mental health, although less is known about that at the point. What the scientists working on it have found is that the noise of traffic is enough to interrupt sleep. Not completely. It may not wake you up unless there's something very loud like a siren, but it keeps you at levels of sleep that are not as deep as they should be. And that has a long-term effect. It can cause anxiety, insomnia in itself. It's set off by the sound, and then it kind of loops back into itself. So sleep deprivation is a major factor, and that affects mood, definitely. Anxiety, depression. It affects irritability. So people who find that they're just waking up annoyed and go through the day like that, this could be a major cause, what you hear at night. What's also been found, particularly by research going on in Europe, there have been extensive studies in Germany, for example, finding that the rate of heart attack is way higher in urban areas where there's constant traffic noise.
Goodness.
If you live under a flight path, similar situation.
Well, it's interesting, something I've been writing about recently under the subheading, a wave of silence spread over the earth during lockdown, and seismometers around the world measured a 50% drop in noise globally during lockdown. There's a fascinating video representation of that actually on YouTube via The Guardian, where you see sound waves and the months passing by. I'll share it with you and I'll put a link out for our audience. But you see these sound bars moving up across the globe. And then you see March 2020 approach, and these sound bars globally start in China, which went into lockdown first, of course. And then the sound bars start to reduce, and you can see this east to west spread of the noise dropping as the world went into lockdown. And of course, the three biggest contributors to noise are air travel, road traffic, and construction industry. Do you think this silence that we've suddenly enjoyed globally during lockdown is going to alert industries that were otherwise extremely loud and make them feel like they ought to do more to protect the hearing of their employees?
I hope that's the case. Yes. because this has been a major problem for people working in factories for a long time, since the 19th century, actually. Mm. And the usual way of dealing with it is put noise cancelling earphones or earplugs, if there isn't the money for earphones, to put those on the workers rather than lowering the ambient noise in the factory. But it's way more important to do that, partly because many workers don't like wearing earphones. They're not comfortable. Mm. And people will take them off whenever they get the chance. So one factor is having a regulation saying that you need to use hearing protection. But another factor is, are people actually using it?
Very true.
And the two don't always line up.
And I suppose as well, in a world where people who are working in factories are now being asked to wear masks, the last thing they want in addition to a mask is headphones.
Yeah, exactly. If you add glasses into that, it's really uncomfortable.
Something we say at QuietMark is that we want to raise awareness of noise pollution. You know, we've seen people's awareness of plastic in the ocean due to programs by David Attenborough, for example, and great nature documentaries, which have made people really think twice about whether they should use single-use plastic bottles, for example, and how they can reduce their plastic usage, their plastic footprint. We need to get to that level with the awareness of noise pollution.
How does that work with the people who are creating the bylaws around noise?
You know, what's controlled and what's permitted? Is there a drive and an awareness to how dangerous noise pollution is?
There is. If you look at industrial noise in North America, there have been attempts to improve regulations, and most cities have reasonably good regulations, although exceptions are made for public festivals, for example. Mm-hmm. And then it's left up to the individual what they're going to do about it. Mm. The real social justice issue in this is that many parts of the world don't have the budget for really effective noise control, nor are they necessarily aware of it because they have so many emergencies to deal with, COVID being one of them, but also lack of food, lack of sanitation, war zones. You know, there are so many people around the world that are not able to live what we would consider normally. Mm. And in those cases, no, there are no bylaws. And even if there are weak ones, they're not enforced. So people are at the mercy of whatever is going on in their workplaces and what's going on in cities, if they're living in a city, and they have no control over what's going on in the neighborhood. They might live near a factory or have buses constantly rumbling through and honking, and they don't sleep well. So all of this is a social justice issue. It needs more attention.
You mentioned just then that people who might hear trucks with sirens moving through the factories that they work in and they don't sleep well. I know when I've been to rock concerts in the past and I didn't sleep well because I could still hear the ringing in my ears from the rock concert. Is that the sort of effect that you're mentioning there for people who work in loud environments?
There is more than one section in the book on tinnitus, which is what you're describing, that ringing in the ears when there's no actual sound going on necessarily. That's a very common effect of noise overload. It happens a lot in rock concerts. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that the tiny receptor cells in the inner ear get frazzled. The protein tips get frazzled by the noise pressure, the sound pressure, and they kind of flop over rather than standing up straight, which is what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And gradually they return to normal position. But if this happens too often, they don't. They remain flattened and fried, basically. And that's where hearing loss comes in. So if you have tinnitus, get checked at an audiology clinic. There are ways to treat it. It's not curable once it sets in permanently, but there are ways to treat it. And that reduces the stress induced by the condition.
Other than reducing the volume of things and maybe not attending spaces which are loud. Is there anything with vitamins or anything that people can be doing to strengthen their susceptibility to this?
Vitamins, probably not, although occasionally you'll find articles about it in health food store magazines. A lot depends on the individual. It depends on the source of the damage. Mm-hmm. It depends on the conditions in which the person with tinnitus is living. So when people go for treatment, there's usually an interview where you're asked about your living conditions. You're asked about what brought on this phenomenon, and an individualized program is worked out for you. Of course, these clinics are not necessarily easy to access. There aren't that many of them yet, and they're not necessarily inexpensive. Yes, we need to look at the sociology of this problem and recognize that more funding, more attention needs to go into training people as practitioners who can help with treating the problem, as well as research into possible medications.
I'd like to revisit what you were saying about your students who, for the first time, had gone on these walks and weren't wearing headphones, which obviously relates to the appreciation of sound in the natural world and maybe stopping for periods of silence. What can you share with us about your findings of your investigations into the benefits of periods of silence and the ability to actually take those periods?
This is getting really good attention now in some circles anyway, and I'm hoping the circles get larger. It ties in with the acoustic ecology movement. Acoustic ecology was founded by Murray Schafer, the Canadian composer, who got quite interested in listening, how people listen and why they listen, and how that works in terms of their awareness of the world. Mm-hmm. This was a practice he worked on with his students for years. And now it's getting into the common knowledge. There are many people writing about sound walking now, which is where, as I said before, you go out for a walk mm-hmm. in whatever environment. It can be a city or a forest or anywhere you choose. And you listen. No talking, no earphones or earbuds. Just listen. So this movement is gaining steam, and I'm hoping it really spreads to more and more people all over the world. And it's bringing in an awareness of natural surroundings so that instead of listening to traffic, you're hearing birds. You may be hearing the birds shouting over the traffic. One of the effects of the pandemic lockdown is that the birds are not yelling as loudly. There are people who know how to measure that. Yes. Yeah, so they're not having to strain to get their calls heard by other birds. And that kind of tells you something, that in the natural state, without all this mechanical noise on top of it, communication happens more easily.
Yeah.
It happens more broadly. And that applies to our human surroundings as well. If you go to a restaurant and you have to shout in order to talk to your friends around the table who aren't sitting that far away from you, that's a problem. It means that your ears are being strained, your auditory system is being strained, and your voice is being strained. So why can't we engineer the walls and the floors and the ceilings of restaurants so that they absorb sound better? And of course, the answer to that is always, well, hard reflective surfaces are easier to clean. But there are materials being produced now that are easy to clean and that absorb sound.
Absolutely. Funnily enough, the episode that we put out just recently, episode 10, talks about one of the lines we use in that is forget the fancy concrete floors, which is the trend, because it creates a Lombard effect where people talk louder to be heard, and it reduces the enjoyment of food. And that was the subject of episode 10 with Mahmoud Alamir, who's an acoustician who studied that and done a study that showed that music at 30 and 40 decibels improved people's perception of the dining experience. But at 50 decibels, it dropped significantly. And so that is something that we really look at. But we know that within QuietMark, we have the Acoustics Academy, which is a platform of materials which go into buildings like flooring, windows, ceilings, and certainly flooring, LVT flooring, is clean. It looks like real wood. It looks like stone. But it has absorptive qualities which improve the acoustics of a space. And so that you can achieve a trendy look, but with really lovely acoustics. And that's vital. You mentioned as well, something I'd like to ask you there when you were talking about sound walks. One thing I would say is to listeners, I had on one of the episodes, earlier episodes, I was playing with an app called Warbler, which everyone knows what Shazam can do for songs. Well, Warbler does this for birdsong. You have your phone in an area, you hold your microphone up, and suddenly it tells you what birds are in the vicinity that you can hear, which is quite fun to do, certainly with young children. But even for an adult, I was amazed to see the sounds of the birds. I live in the centre of the city of London, and during lockdown, I could hear all sorts of birds and learn about them, what they were. So I recommend Warbler. But with the sound walks, is there a process to them? You said letting listening lead the way. But is there a game? Are you noting things down? Are you recording things? Or are you just listening?
All of those possibilities are there. You can take a notebook and scribble down what you're hearing and think about it later. You can take recordings. You can go with a group of people and not talk during the walk, but discuss it afterward, because everybody is going to notice different things about what they've heard.
Yeah. Now, I'm not trying to encourage people onto their devices. We've been talking about the need to get off devices. Nevertheless, there is an application called Hush City, an application which encourages people to record areas of silence, maybe take photographs, maybe record them. I believe I've only just downloaded it, so I'm speaking as the uninitiated, but I've read a little bit about it. But the creators of Hush City are trying to map quiet places around the world to create a community of people, I guess, who are going on sound walks.
Yes, it's a brilliant idea. And the whole concept is that there's so much attention to noise in cities, whether one is for it or against it. There's a lot of attention. What about the quiet places? How do you find them?
And of course,
one of the hazards of that is that once the quiet places are mapped and everyone knows where they are, they'll get crowds.
Yeah, never tell anyone about that quiet villa that you found in the Greek islands. Everyone goes there for their holidays and that's it, game over.
One of my cats is coughing right now. Can you hear that?
No, I can't.
Is it recording? Okay, good.
No.
Okay.
What's the cat called?
That's Griffin. The other one is Gracie.
Griffin and Gracie. I love it. Well, Gesundheit, Griffin. I'd like to come back to the book because I'm eagerly awaiting the arrival of my copy from Amazon. It should arrive soon. And looking at that, there's a fantastic range of chapter titles. I was almost amused to see the first one, which was Life Without Earlids, not least because Richard Grove of BDP was talking about not having earlids in episode one. What can you tell us about Life Without Earlids?
Right. Okay. That term, no earlids, comes from Murray Schafer.
Oh.
And it's about how we can decide not to look at things. We can close our eyes.
Yeah.
We can't decide not to hear things because there's nothing to pull over the ears. Yeah. So yeah, we are constantly taking in sound, and a lot of it is not taken in consciously. There's a difference between hearing and listening. Listening takes attention. So this is one of the things that the acoustic ecology movement and I are encouraging, that we pay more attention to what we're hearing. Because we're hearing, even in sleep, people in comas can hear, which is why it's really important for surgeons and medical staff to be careful what they say when somebody is under anesthetic.
Goodness. Yeah.
There have been studies done on that. Recovery rates from surgery are affected.
That's interesting. Certainly, my next guest I'm speaking to is Yoko Sen, and she is a musician in a hospital, and she is someone who heard the noise of certain alarms within the hospital. She talks about alarm fatigue and how there are so many alarms that often some of them get ignored. But nevertheless, she was also saying that two machines were playing opposing notes and forming a singular chord, which was known as the devil's chord, which was forbidden from cathedrals in medieval times and hardly conducive to recovery. So that's the last thing you want to be hearing awake or in a coma, it seems.
Yes. Unfortunately, a lot of the machinery that keeps people alive in intensive care units is very noisy. And of course, sleep is crucial to healing. So this is another area where the people that you work with who design low sound or sound absorbing equipment need to be.
Absolutely. Well, certainly Saint-Gobain Ecophon, who create panels, acoustic panels that go on walls and on ceilings, have a large presence within hospitals in improving the acoustics of hospitals. They've done the same in classrooms, and they've recognized that when they treat classrooms acoustically, the decibel level of the tutor rose by 10% in a certain classroom. And when a place was treated acoustically, a classroom, attendance went up, well-being increased, absenteeism decreased, results improved, and the school achieved outstanding results in the governmental studies. It increased its status due to acoustic treatment. So it is a vital, totally vital area of treatment.
Yeah. Well, one of my chapters is about noise in schools and how it affects learning. And it's wonderful that there are solutions out there now.
Yeah.
Again, it's a matter of figuring out how schools can afford those solutions. Yeah. So that's where more funding is needed.
Okay. Another headline that's hitting me here, Marcia, is Thunder Rooster Hammer Hum. What is that?
Yes.
Please explain that.
Okay. That chapter is a speculative history of noise.
Oh.
And what gave me the idea to do it was finding that until the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th, 19th centuries started, there was really very little out there that would damage hearing, although noise annoyance was another factor. There was certainly noise annoyance probably back through prehistory. Thunder being an example, yes, and cartwheels on cobblestones, all sorts of things like that. So I went into what I call auditory imagination, and because I'm a historian as well, went into what would a prehistoric settlement have sounded like in a forest or a desert, and what would people have listened for? What would they have heard? What would have disturbed them? What would have soothed them? So there are little vignettes in that chapter of what did it sound like in a small village of hunter-gatherers? What would it sound like in a little town in the Middle Ages in Europe? And going through into the Industrial Revolution, into the 20th century with all the technology and the cars starting up. And what does it sound like now with a largely indoor soundscape because people are working in cities, in offices, as well as factories? And how does that affect what they notice, what they are annoyed by, and what they like? Because that's a neglected area of sound, sound investigation. We know quite a bit about what's annoying and what's noisy. We don't know a whole lot about how to do design so that there are pleasant and comforting sounds around. So that's an area that city planners are starting to get into, and it's wonderful. Fountains, for example, and sound sculptures that are activated by the wind and produce lovely sounds very gently, just soothing people. Those can be very useful in hospital situations as well, as long as the volume level is kept low. For that matter, you mentioned musicians in hospitals before. Wonderful idea. Yes.
Well, Brian Eno, who's one of my favourite composers, yes. And from ambient music and music for airports, and he's a fantastic soundscape producer. He creates not notes, but ambience, atmospheres. And he has been working on sounds and experiments that he's been doing at Hove Hospital, where he's been looking at the way of changing the sound of alarms so that everything has a much more atmospheric ambient thing. And so, yes, it's fantastic that musicians are engaging with hospitals and looking at the way that they can create a soundscape, which actually is conducive to recovery and relaxation. It's really, really important. We talked about apps jokingly earlier, but actually some of the biggest, most successful apps these days are the well-being meditative apps, which has been wonderful. People have become more aware of what they're eating, what they're putting inside their bodies food-wise. Yoga has become increasing. It used to be something done by the hippies, and now, you know, some of the biggest videos during lockdown, in fact, have been home yoga tutorials. There is a real wave that people are embracing wellness, mindfulness. But it's very rare, if at all, that something on that wellness industry, which is burgeoning and huge, nevertheless is a sound or a hearing related experience, application, video, or whatever. It seems like it's the next area of the wellness industry that needs to be embraced. Certainly Hush City is doing something, but I don't think that I'm seeing the zeitgeist quite aware yet. We're doing our bit, but it's great. It does put to mind how willing the world is to embrace wellness right now, but how little of it is focused on sound. Would you agree?
Yes, with some qualification. Okay, I've checked out a lot of meditation videos on YouTube to find out what their soundtracks are like, and especially the ones where there's a voice speaking over the ambient music.
Yeah.
And what I find in so many of them, I can't listen to them because the music, it's okay. Sometimes it's even really good. And then there's a voice like this coming over and giving some kind of narration. No. So awareness of speech is also very important. Awareness of what you're conveying with your voice. This is something that actors and singers know, but the general public doesn't. Mm. And maybe that should get into the school system at some point, somewhere. And we need depth in this area. We need sincerity. We need investigation. Yes.
Yeah, we do.
And we need awareness of how what we hear is affecting our everyday lives.
Do you have a program in your daily life that you try to adhere to in order to take those moments for quiet and absorb the benefits of that silence? Is it something you consciously put into your schedule, so to speak?
Not as much as I should, to be honest. I'm about to go on sabbatical for several months starting in January, and I have a plan to develop that into my daily schedule.
So, okay, what boxes do you need to tick during your sabbatical in order to achieve the quiet that you seek?
Yes. Well, setting aside time every day to practice at least one of my instruments, which are sadly neglected because teaching from home means that there is no barrier between work and home. So the work takes over, as I'm sure many of your listeners know very well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Work from home may be the new normal, but when are we home from work is the big question.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad to hear you're learning instruments. But some people might go, hang on, quiet and learning an instrument, those two don't go hand in hand, or do they?
Well, instruments I play is the lute. Not really well, but I do play it.
The lute.
And Peter Schickele's comment about the lute is that if there are any other instruments playing, you can't hear it, which is not true. But So it's not a loud instrument, let's put it that way.
Okay, yeah. So learning instruments. And I'll come back to the lute in a moment, because I know that relates okay. to your first book. Of course, mm-hmm. Sound and Noise isn't your first book, it's your second book. But for now, okay, so you're on sabbatical. Learning instrument is one thing that you, like you say, when you're taking time away from work, you want to make time to learn an instrument. And that's something that is sound related, but also brings you peace and calm. What else would you yes. be doing?
Just keeping the house quiet for periods of time, turning on the podcasts or the TV or the radio or any of the equivalents online, and just listening to the quiet, because I fortunately live in a quiet neighborhood, actually less so since the pandemic lockdown, because kids are running around in the streets, where they were in the summer, not so much now. And some people in the larger neighborhood have acquired motorbikes.
Oh, wow.
Every so often the quiet is punctuated by new sounds, yeah. But thinking about living in noisy surroundings, living in a busy city, it's harder to do that. So using the earphones or the earbuds constructively can help. Play a soft instrumental, for example, or chanting, you know, whatever religious or spiritual group you come from or want to move into, there are probably some nice, calm, chant-like examples of music that you can use to get your nervous system relaxed. Mm. So that's a possibility. If you don't play any instruments and most of the music you listen to is, you know, pounding beats and screaming, give yourself a break. Listen to something quiet. If you have a business and you're playing music mm-hmm. in the background, it's really common in that situation to play very popular songs, or sometimes pop songs from a few decades ago.
Yeah.
Not the best idea, because the words distract people from concentrating on what you're selling, especially if it's something like a bookstore. You want to be able to enable people to read bits of what's in front of them mm. and decide whether they want to actually get the book. So in that case, soft instrumentals are your best friend.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I have ambient playlists and Japanese ambient playlists that I listen to. Another thing that I'm doing in my program, just to share this, is that, yes, I cycle and I find somewhere where I can have coffee, park my bike, sit on a bench and be in a field, in a park, by a canal, somewhere which is quiet. But I also try to take a quiet meal. And something I read recently was that breakfast is a meal that often is taken alone. I eat dinner with my family, which I love doing, especially during lockdown. But breakfast is something which happens at different times for the people in the house. And it sometimes becomes a solo experience. And it's something where I've really tried to make sure I don't have my phone. I don't necessarily have music on, because I play music all the time. I'm a music crazy, as our audience will know. But nevertheless, I think breakfast is a time where I can just, the only sound I'll hear is the spoon hitting the muesli, so to speak. And I quite enjoy that, even if it's only 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's nice to do that. I end up talking to my dog most of the time through it.
Yes, my cats end up talking to me at
the time. Griffin and Gracie just not giving you a break. Well, I, you know, wish you well that sabbatical, and it's fantastic that off the back of completing a book, you have this, did you say 6 month sabbatical?
Yes.
You know, you have all this learning from writing the book, and then you have this 6 month mm-hmm. sabbatical in order to benefit from that wisdom that you've gained. How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, it was an on and off process, but it stretches back 10 years. That's not unusual for academics.
No.
It takes a long time to get evidence together. And publishers are not always terribly speedy, because the manuscript has to go out for peer review, mm-hmm. and then it has to get revised, and then it has to go out for review again. And then there's copy editing and formatting and all that kind of thing. So it takes a while.
It must do. And being, you said you were a lecturer as well. So just sitting being an author wasn't the day job. You were juggling all sorts of other stuff.
Right.
Was that hard?
Yes, and singing in two or three choirs.
Oh, really? Tell us a bit about that. Who are the choirs? What sort of stuff are you singing?
Well, I sing with two early music choirs that meet regularly.
Mm.
One of them does Baroque and the other does Renaissance and a bit of medieval. And of course, we're on lockdown rehearsals right now. We're all on Zoom from our homes and we can't turn the sound on because Zoom scrambles the timing terribly.
Right, right.
And it sounds like a complete mess.
Oh, no.
So we practice with our microphones turned off.
Ah.
And yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Now, I can't claim to know anything about Baroque music, but a modern band who were inspired by Bruegel paintings is Fleet Foxes. Mm. Do you know Fleet Foxes?
No, I'll check them out.
They're amazing. But the first album by the Fleet Foxes was very popular, but it was a very sort of Baroque sound, and it's very layered voices, and it's a thing of beauty. So, but we'll have to swap some musical tips on that maybe. But I would like, but that does bring us neatly onto your first book. Tell us a bit about your first book, if you wouldn't mind, please.
Right. Well, my first book was the result of my graduate work in medieval music, and it's a collection of songs from two manuscripts in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Which are devotional songs in Old French, or actually Old into Middle French. It's kind of a transition period. But it was amazing because I got to actually go over there and handle the manuscripts. And they are so incredibly beautiful. Yeah, just thinking of the way every letter in every word was shaped by hand. And the concentration it took and the training it took for the scribes to be able to do that. It would take months to produce one book.
Tell us a bit more about the book, if you would, please.
Well, it really came from an idea that came up in a discussion with my doctoral thesis advisor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He pointed out that there was all kinds of attention to secular trouvère songs, the Northern French late medieval writers of songs and lyrics, but there wasn't much attention to the devotional ones.
Right.
And there were some that had been transcribed and published, but a lot of them were just in manuscript form. So that got me all excited about the possibility of studying them. And I worked from microfilms at first. Remember microfilms? Maybe
yes,
not.
I do.
Yeah, so after the transcriptions were done from the microfilms, I was able to go over to Paris and look at the real thing and found that there were all kinds of little spots on the microfilms that I thought were notes, but in fact they were spots. Looking at the real manuscripts, I was able to revise the transcriptions. Yeah. And then came putting the transcriptions into readable notation. I did transcriptions in the style of the original notation and then a set of transcriptions in modern notation. And the thing about trouvère songs is that there were no rules recorded for the rhythm. The notes are right there, but how long to hold them and what the rhythmic patterns were was not really talked about in any of the treatises from that time.
Ah.
So the transcriber has to kind of think about that. And what made the most sense, and I think it's pretty much standard now, is to go by the text accentuation.
Yeah.
So it produced some really interesting results.
That's very interesting.
The book is still out there, as far as I know. It can be quite useful for scholars of medieval music and also for singers.
Yeah. What was the book title, please?
It's called Prions en chantant in French, colon, because all academic titles have colons.
Of course.
Yes. Devotional songs of the trouvères, the singers and songwriters of the late Middle Ages in Northern France.
I've just finished reading How Music Works by David Byrne, the singer of Talking Heads. It's a fantastic book, but he talks similarly to what you're saying there, how a sheet of music will show you what notes need to be played and what timing, but it's very difficult to know what the composer's intention is for dynamics and volume of notes on that page. And of course, there's the Italian terms of allegro and pizzicato and certain cues which give you an idea as to what it's supposed to be like. But in the book, there are illustrations by composers who were drawing a whole other language of music, which was telling the story of how the musical notes ought to be played in the order that they're shown on the music, which is amazing. And certainly one of my favourite albums of all time is Kind of Blue by Miles Davis, where he turned up to the studio, to the quintet, and showed them illustrations and paintings and sketches and said, this is how I want you to play, which and it produced one of the most popular, well, the highest selling jazz album of all time, funnily enough, was created under that mechanics.
I have a couple of examples of that too. Murray Schafer's scores are very pictorial as well. They? And some of his compositions are meant to be played in the outdoors, in the wilderness. So all of the sound coming from the forest or the water or both actually also figure in to what he was intending. I also had a personal experience with that, with hearing Philip Glass play some of his piano works live.
Oh, wow.
And I had never really clicked with his style before that in recordings. You know, okay, you know, interesting, but I wasn't really caught up in it. And then hearing him live was amazing. Yeah, just waves of emotion coming out of these very simple rapid-fire formulas overlapping with each other. And I understood what he was trying to get at, what he was getting at.
Incredible.
The first time when I heard him playing it.
It's interesting, an environment's influence on music. You know, I think of people like Antonio Carlos Jobim, who's a famous Brazilian composer, you know, bossa novas and sambas, but they sound like Brazil. They sound...
Yes.
They really have that sunshine, whereas Kraftwerk and industrial German electronica music, which I love, nevertheless, it couldn't come from anywhere other than Germany in 1979, you know what I mean?
And it's engineering music.
It really is, yeah. And it's fantastic, our environment's influence on music. What did you feel was the connection between what you'd previously written and your second book? What was that pathway for you?
Well, working with medieval music involves listening in a very different way from what we're used to. And I suppose that gave me some background in what is involved in consciously listening, rather than just letting it pass by. You have to concentrate. And, you know, any musician knows this. You have to concentrate on what the patterns are, what the timing is, what the combinations of sounds are. Mm. I do a little bit, just occasional, composing for choirs. And what I generally do is pick up ideas from music that I've heard combined with what I was feeling at the time and with what's going on around me in the present. Yeah, so having studied ethnomusicology as well, world music, all of those possible combinations and overlaps of sounds from different cultures, this is a real thing in folk music as well, that you don't just stick with one country or one region, you combine and overlap. Some of the more creative groups in folk rock fusion have been doing that. And it produces some really interesting results. There's so much to listen to. Well, the final chapter of the book is about how here we are caught up in, at least in North America, and I think in Western culture generally, we're caught up in the idea that everything is a competition. The model we're using for interaction is sports much of the time. Mm. Sports are competitive,
yeah.
And it's all about fighting. Even in medical terms, we're fighting diseases, we're fighting COVID. And what I suggest in that final chapter is that we need other models. We need a lot of different models, but one of them should be music, which is all about cooperation and the need to listen to each other in order to make sense of what's going on.
I love that.
Yeah.
Marcia, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me this morning for you, this afternoon for me. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
For me as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, my copy of the book did arrive, and I've been reading it each evening. At the beginning, there's a part that Marcia wrote in May 2020, which is called Preface in Mid-Pandemic, and I'd like to share that with you before we finish the show. At any other time, this moment would be held within a suburban rush hour, somewhat muted by its distance from the downtown core, but characterized by a variegated soft whooshing roar interspersed with the rumbles of trucks on a nearby freeway. Today, there is quiet. The pandemic keeps us all at home and usually indoors, with businesses and schools closed. Traffic is sparse and sporadic, while aircraft have been almost absent for nearly 2 months. Bird calls, often relegated to an indistinct background, are easily audible now. Crows and magpies, sparrows and robins, and chickadees, now and then a gliding hawk. I listen while reading about the sounds of other lockdown places, thanks to colleagues in the World Forum of Acoustic Ecology, WFAE, who share their carefully observed soundscapes in emails and recordings. These recordings include birds in Australia, England and Czech Republic, street protests in Brazil, and someone opening a creaky gate to walk down a traffic-free street in Rome on a Saturday afternoon. There are neighbourhood gratitude demonstrations, applause, whoops, clackers, bells, clanging pots, car horns, a trumpet, a cello, every evening, supporting healthcare workers all over Canada. Just as we now travel virtually through videos, we can eavesdrop on everything from wilderness to urban centres. Reports come in, as well, about the calls of urban birds being less loud than usual as they adjust to the quieter environment, no longer straining to be heard above human soundscapes. Human listeners interpret the conversation of trees and wind, recognising the dialects of leaf shape and density. Ambient sound level readings taken in major cities show nighttime levels during the day. Quiet may be hard to find indoors as children are home and music, news, computer games and videos are in constant play. Gaps left by cancelled activities get filled with whatever the raises spirits, a practice with historical precedent. Literature about the plagues that occurred in the local waves in Europe from the 14th to 17th centuries show that music was considered crucial for keeping people from despair. Along with funerals and masses for the dead and processions for chanting penitents, there were sprightly dances and folk songs described in stories, but not preserved in notation. I imagine flutes and drums, bagpipes, fiddles, frenzies of dancing to keep fear at bay. Sound makes us aware of larger worlds than the ones we can see. So do silences, as field recordings from Europe and North America grow in number. Large areas of the world are currently voiceless for lack of recording equipment or of computer and internet access, or because people lack sufficient health or time for sharing experiences. We wait for a new normal. Will it bring more awareness of our connections to each other and the natural world? Will we hear our everyday lives more clearly? Marcia Jenneth Epstein, Calgary, Canada, May 2020. Will we hear our everyday lives more clearly in the new normal? That's a great question from a great thinker. I really enjoyed my conversation with Marcia, and yes, I did share Fleet Foxes with her, and she commented on how Crosby, Stills and Nash they sounded, so we're already exchanging musical tips. But that question, will we hear our everyday lives more clearly, is a truly poignant question, Certainly QuietMark, as I say at the beginning of every show, seeks to prioritise noise reduction within the design of everyday machines and appliances and find solutions to noise problems to benefit health and well-being. That's something we've done since Poppy Skeeler founded the company almost a decade ago. And it's something we've taken even further with the launch of our Acoustics Academy, a brand new online platform which is further equipping and empowering architects, builders and designers with a guide to expertly verified leading acoustic solutions for every building application area. We're passionate about improving acoustics in the built environment, and we hope that this podcast helps to raise awareness and understanding of the many benefits that good acoustics brings to people and makes it more of a priority when it comes to designing the places that we live and work in. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Quiet Mark podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. We've got some fantastic guests in the pipeline, including Yoko Sen, a sound artist and founder of Sen Sound, and a great TED speaker who, as you heard me mention in the program, is a musician who is working with the manufacturers of the machines which create the beeps and the bleeps and the alarms within hospitals and seeing if she can make those sounds more human. I mentioned in this episode Hush City, the app which maps quiet places around the world, and I'm delighted that Dr. Antonella Radici, the inventor of Hush City, has agreed to appear on the show. So I look forward to sharing those shows with you in the lead up to Christmas and into the new year. Thanks again for listening. Join us again soon. For now, take care, stay safe, and bye-bye. Bye for now.